The headlines this hour. The U.S. military slams recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing amid recent tensions over Taiwan. Indian police tighten security as thousands of new farmers join protesters near the capital, New Delhi, over the government's agricultural policies. Also coming up, Bangladesh sends hundreds more Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island despite opposition from rights groups. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. military has slammed recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing. The U.S. military's Pacific Command says the flights over the past week were, quote, aggressive behavior. It says, however, the fighter jets pose no threat to a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group in the region. The group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea recently amid tensions between China and Taiwan. Stephen Mube is our correspondent joining us from Beijing. So, kind of don't understand what the opposition is here from the U.S. because it said that the flights were not threatening any of their vessels, but at the same time, it has slammed the moves.
Well, they kind of were threatening the U.S. aircraft carrier strike group because they were conducting a drill that was an operation, a simulation of an operation against an aircraft carrier. Possibly to sink it. But as you say, they didn't come within 250 nautical miles of the Theodore Roosevelt carrier strike group. Basically what happened was that this strike group was entered the South China Sea via the Bashi Strait, which is the channel between the Philippines and Taiwan, and then it proceeded onwards to the Prata Island, which is to the west. And on January the 23rd, while this was happening, China started conducting these drills in the southwest corner of Taiwan's air defense identification zone. So you could see this as something like another drill intended to intimidate or warn Taiwan. But more than that, it would be a threat of sorts against this carrier group. A lot of experts think that China could sink an aircraft carrier. And this squadron of planes included fighter jets and H-6 bombers. So it's kind of like China saying to the U.S., we don't want you to come into the South China Sea because this is our territory. The U.S., of course, has said it will continue with these so-called freedom of navigation exercises. As I was saying, something of a threat against a U.S. aircraft carrier group, even though it was a long way away.
Okay, we know what has been said by the Chinese government, but are there any signs of diplomatic breakthrough of any kind to come between U.S. and China when it comes to the military arena? As we can see, you know, pressure is being ratcheted up in some sense by many provocations that are coming from the U.S. side?
Well, of course, the U.S. would say that this is international water, and China would say this is its territory. What should become clear is U.S. President Joe Biden's position on this, because after Trump came to power, he did actually step up these freedom of navigation exercises. That was a kind of marked departure from the stance of Obama. So over the coming months, whether Biden's going to continue with Trump on this or whether he's going to dial it down a bit, the indications are that he's going to continue with these freedom of navigation exercises, which is opposition and refusal to acknowledge or rejection of China's claim to nearly the entire South China Sea.
Thank you for that, Stephen Rebo, correspondent there from Beijing. Many thanks. The U.S. and South Korea plan to carry out joint military exercises this spring. drawing international calls for the drills to be suspended. Nearly 400 activist organizations in South Korea and around the world signed a joint statement calling on new U.S. President Joe Biden to suspend the exercises, even as military officials in Seoul and Washington suggested the maneuvers would go ahead. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before, in the early 1990s, as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States, and what signals can give to North Korea at this point?
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Indian farmers have launched a hunger strike near the capital, Delhi, in protest at the government's agricultural reforms.
We will not hide behind the force of violence. Until the three laws are taken back, we are not moving from here.
Farmers' leaders say the strike demonstrates the peaceful nature of the protest, coincides with the death anniversary of independence leader Mahatma Gandhi. Police have tightened security and internet services and have been blocked in several areas around New Delhi. Protesters are angry at new legislation that they say benefits large corporations at the expense of smaller producers. For over 2 months, tens of thousands of farmers have camped at protest sites on the outskirts of the capital to demand the abolition of the law. Violence erupted on Tuesday during a tractor parade in New Delhi to mark India's Republic Day. Clashes left one person dead and hundreds injured. Bangladesh has sent another batch of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite opposition from rights groups. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basan Char. This is the newest addition to the roughly 3,500 refugees already sent to the islands since early December. Dhaka claims it is only moving those who are willing to leave the overcrowded camps in the town of Cox's Bazar. However, humanitarian groups say the refugees have been forced to leave. The UN has also criticized the relocation, saying the world body has not been allowed to evaluate the living conditions on the flood-prone island. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims crossed into Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown on the stateless ethnic minority group in 2017. The top aide to U.S. President Joe Biden says the new administration's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The White House National Security Advisor claimed that Tehran is moving, quote, closer to having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Jake Sullivan made the remarks as the Biden administration has signaled that it wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal the previous administration had abandoned. Sullivan did not mention Biden's often stated precondition that Iran make the first move by resuming its full compliance with its commitments under the deal. Iran has underlined that it was the U.S. that unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 deal, and therefore it needs to take the first step by lifting sanctions and complying with the terms of the agreement. Political commentator Tawhid Asadi believes the policy of the new U.S. administration on Iran is very much the same as that of the Trump administration. The only difference is in the rhetoric that's being used.
The new administration in the White House tries to send out this signal that the United States has changed its course of action and its course of, let's say, policy behavior pertaining to Iran. But practically speaking, we see that this is the same old repetition of, let's say, baseless allegations, and this is going to be nothing but dancing with the same old tune. For the 4 years that we had with President Trump, former President Trump, indeed, we had this same behavior repeatedly taking place, but the only difference was that when it came to statements and when it came to, let's say, stated policies, Trump's Trump administration and Trump himself, they were very much frank and clear. But this double standards, specifically when it comes to Biden administration, in terms of the recent days, recent few days that we have observed, the truth of the matter is that we have seen this combination of allegations, some of them baseless, of course, many of them baseless. The United States and the officials currently speaking at the White House are trying to kind of complicate the whole situation.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara have a common stance that the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed his talks with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu as constructive, friendly, and fruitful. Zarif also noted that ways to expand bilateral ties, regional cooperation, and the latest developments in Syria, Iraq, and the Caucasus were among the main topics discussed in the talks. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a Twitter post at the end of his visit to Turkey.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
Iran, ABD.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus, aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common, and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now, with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A team of experts led by the World Health Organization tasked with investigating the origin of COVID-19 has begun field visits in the Chinese city of Wuhan after a two-week quarantine. The team paid a visit to one of Wuhan's main hospitals, which treated patients in the early stages of the pandemic. The team is also scheduled to visit labs, markets, and other hospitals during its remaining days in the city. China has warned against any political interference in the mission. The investigators arrived in Wuhan on January 14th. To make sure that they are not exposed to the disease, they spent 14 days in a hotel, where they started the probe through online meetings with Chinese scientists. The first known cluster of coronavirus was detected in Wuhan in December 2019. Calls to shut down the Napier barracks in Kent, which is being described as the UK's first unofficial refugee camp, are getting louder. Residents say that their living conditions are becoming unbearable, and social distancing amid a COVID-19 outbreak is practically impossible. Nonetheless, the government says the barracks are safe and are of very high standard.
Fake blood being washed away, hours after activists threw it at the gates of the Napier barracks in Kent, trying to highlight human rights violations taking place here. Security was tighter than usual when we arrived, and the occupants were reluctant to come forward.
Independent organizations, charities, and the residents themselves describe conditions here at the barracks as inhumane and unbearable. This was not what asylum seekers who risked life and limb to get to British shores were expecting. There have been protests, hunger strikes, and suicide attempts.
After an outbreak of COVID-19, morale deteriorated even further. Around 28 people were sharing the same space, toilet and shower, including those who tested positive. Literally trapped, some residents have slept outside in the cold for fear of catching the virus. But the government insists the barracks are COVID-19 compliant. On January 26th, the Secretary of State for the Home Department slapped down Labour MP Zara Sultana for demanding the dignity of the residents be respected and more suitable housing arranged for them.
Because of coronavirus, we need space for social distancing, which has been absolutely in place. These accommodation sites are in line with Public Health England guidance, as we've always checked guidance and worked with PHE throughout coronavirus when it comes to accommodation. I can see the Honourable Lady shaking her head. Perhaps she'd like to listen to the facts and not some of the sort of jaded views that she may hold herself.
That said, less than 24 hours later, dozens of residents were moved out of the barracks with very short notice and taken to a hotel nearby. These men all tested negative for COVID-19, but as they made clear, they were not allowed to exit the building or talk to us, even from a safe distance. There have been reports of them being threatened with delayed responses to their asylum applications if they are too forthcoming with the media. The atmosphere was somber in Kent, and people had mixed feelings towards the migrants.
This is probably going to sound very unkind to say it, but if they left for better conditions here, all right, they may not be what they were expecting, but if they were good enough for the army in the old days, the barracks, why aren't they good enough for them? And that sounds awful, I know, and I'm going to get slated for saying that, but that is my view.
They're people, you know, they're trying to have a better life. Obviously, where they're coming from, the majority of them is horrendous. So I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. I mean, I like to think that we're at the end of the day, we're human beings going to try and cope with this as best as we can without blaming people all the time.
I know it's war-torn places and all that, but the law says that the first country they come to, they're supposed to seek asylum, but they're not. They're just coming straight through. This is where they want to get to because it's easy pickings. We're too easy on them. Sorry, but that's my opinion of it.
In an open letter to the British people in January, the residents of Napier Barracks described their living conditions and called for compassion. These men are finding it increasingly difficult to see light at the end of the tunnel, with asylum applications in limbo and their freedom of movement curtailed even more due to the pandemic. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that does for all this.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today.
Division and violence keep harming the Central African Republic after disputed elections, while foreign powers such as France maintain their military presence in the former French colony. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we'll try to find out details of the underreported conflict in the Central African Republic. We'll ask, what do the people of the Central African Republic want? And give you a little history about the nation suffering under the iron hand of foreign forces. In the second part of the show, we'll look at the harrowing bloodshed in Mozambique and its impact on the daily lives of people. Stay with us.
CAR on Path to Chaos. The political opposition has rejected incumbent's re-election, and six powerful armed groups are now united to give Faustin Archange Touadéra a hard time after being declared president for another term. There were also reports of voter intimidation, but the government and some international observers said the election has been held properly.
The members of the Security Council recalled that it will be up to the Constitutional Court of the Central African Republic to proclaim the final results. They called on all political actors to resolve any electoral disputes peacefully and in accordance with the laws and constitution of the Central African Republic. They also called on the government of the Central African Republic and the entire political class to engage in dialogue to promote national stability.
The opposition party called for an annulment of the election, arguing that voting did not take place in many areas. France has meanwhile sent warplanes for various missions. We are joined by Lawrence Freeman to take a closer look at the situation. Mr. Freeman, first of all, what is France up to in the Central African Republic?
The French involvement is very difficult, problematic for the country, because the history of the Central African Republic was that it had to liberate itself from the colonial press of France in 1960. And the French did very, very little, nothing, to develop the nation. And when the nation achieved independence, it almost immediately went into a spiral of violence and coup and other policies, and the people of CAR, Central African Republic, have really never been able to develop their country.
Thanks for that, Mr. Lawrence Freeman, and stay tuned. We have much more in store for you.
Allegations of ballot disappearance and other irregularities elongated announcement of the previous victory gained by Touadéra in 2016 after a turbulent coup. Hundreds of thousands were unable to cast their vote in areas held by the opposition. The opposition forces launch attacks on the capital Bangui and other areas held by the government or foreign forces.
The enemy is composed of rebels from all over the Central African Republic. Coming from the borders of Cameroon, Chad, Sudan, the Fulani in the interior of the country, the anti-Balaka and the Gabaya majority military, including gendarmes and police, they are all in this coalition. Their size is about 9,000 men. Their intention is to overthrow the government in place and force the population into submission in 3 days.
Over 100,000 people have been forced out of their homes across the country. And this is the situation the president has to deal with. For now, Mr. Touadéra looks set to be holding on to power. But will the opposition tolerate? Mr. Freeman, how do you see the future of the situation in the Central African Republic?
Well, we have to start thinking long-term about the future of the country. And the future of the country will not be solved by military. We have to get to the point where the various opposing groups in the country realize that it's in their best interest to work together, to fight for, to struggle for the development of their nation as one country and one identity. And that's difficult, but it's possible to get people to realize that and drop the military confrontationist tactics and find a way, even if it's uncomfortable, for all the people of CAR to join together for the national development of their nation.
Thanks for that, Mr. Freeman. And as you say, unity is key to the future of the Central African Republic.
The impoverished nation lives in one of the most mineral-rich countries in the world. Central African Republic also remains one of the most underreported regions in the world with little access to unbiased news. The country has a dark history of human rights violation and violence arising from repeated coups and lack of a powerful central government.
The UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is today calling for the immediate end to all violence in the Central African Republic. Nearly 60,000 people have been forced to seek refuge in neighboring countries in the past month, a twofold rise in just 1 week. Most refugees have fled across the Ubangi River into the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, where the number of arrivals topped 50,000 after 10,000 Central African refugees arrived in a single day on the 13th of January.
Central African Republic's fragile humanitarian situation is worsening, and more than half of the population are reportedly in vital need of humanitarian assistance. Today, the opposition groups reportedly control two-thirds of the country, areas where most of the diamond and gold mines exist. All the wealth and people are struggling. How could that be explained?
The Central African Republic may be the poorest nation in the world. I'm not sure, I haven't looked at every other nation, but in terms of basic parameters of economic development, it's at the lowest end. And this condition is what is driving all the other processes aside from the actual outside instigators. The people in CAR are not provided with a standard of living necessary to maintain themselves and their family and their children. And under these conditions, the violence is very great.
Some of the refugees escaping the conflict head towards neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and the Republic of Congo. The humanitarian assistance by foreign NGOs and aid agencies did not seem enough. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has called for $151.5 million this year to respond to the Central African Republic situation.
I also heard gunshots and I was scared. I told them to wait for me so I could check things out and link up with them afterwards. So they left without looking back. I still as yet do not know where my family is. How are they going to live? If they have run away, how are they going to live?
Central African Republic authorities, meanwhile, are seeking the lifting of the arms embargo to have an upper hand against opposition forces. The constant skirmishes amount to a marked increase in violence, and fighting goes on with no end in sight. So what is the best route the nation can take in the days ahead?
There is no alternative but to have the centralized government in Bangui. The rest of the country is very poor, and there's no ability to run the nation unless the nation is put on a positive course for economic development for its people. And this will require support from the rest of the world. The country is too weak to carry it out itself. And without this long-term commitment, I'm not sure how quickly or easily we will escape the present horrible, horrible conditions that the citizens of the Central African Republic are suffering from right now.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Lawrence Freeman.
France officially gave independence to CAR in 1960, but has maintained its presence in the chaos following its formal departure. CAR's significance is reiterated with reports of military presence by other countries such as Russia and Rwanda.
The Secretary General remains very concerned over continued destabilization efforts by armed groups in the Central African Republic and calls on all parties to stop violence and engage in meaningful dialogue. He commends the continued engagement of the UN peacekeepers and their efforts to protect civilians and preserve national stability. The Secretary General reiterates the commitment of the UN working closely with national, regional, and international partners to support the cause of peace in the Central African Republic.
The central government only controls one-third of the country, and the rest is under the influence of different armed groups. Basic necessities are becoming scarcer, and prices are soaring due to insecurity on the supply routes.
Tensions currently appear to be on the rise in the country, and violence could spiral out of control in the impoverished nation. Mr. Freeman, what do you personally think the rest of the world should do in regard to the situation?
They're very, very poor and very underdeveloped. Even though they have natural resources, such as water and other capabilities. The government in Bangui, which is really the only modern part of the country, its capital, Bangui, has to be supported. And there has to be policies put in place, supported by the rest of the world, especially the leading powers, such as China and Russia and the U.S., have to support policies for massive economic development of the nation.
Thanks for that, Mr. Freeman, and we all look forward to peace in the Central African Republic.
Bloodshed in Mozambique.
Shocking news coming out of Mozambique have horrified many in the region. Takfiri terrorists beheaded more than 50 people in the northern Mozambique, frightening the communities. The militants, who reportedly have ties with the Daesh terrorist group, turned a football pitch into an execution ground in the gas-rich Cabo Delgado province.
We hear they are Al-Shabaab or gangs, but to tell you the truth, it is a sad situation that we don't know who is behind these attacks.
Those actions did not target Christians. They were against citizens. They killed both Christians and Muslims, as well as those who practice traditional religions. We do not have religious problems.
There were separate reports of beheadings in other villages, a signature tactic by Daesh to spread fear. The 50 villagers recently beheaded were among those who tried to escape, but were captured by the militants. The atrocity reportedly continued for some time.
We are now joined by Bayomi Azikiwe, editor at Pan-African Newswire, to discuss more details about the situation. Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, tell us more about the situation in Mozambique and the Muslim communities there.
Now, the Muslim population in Mozambique is very small, less than 10% of the population, but many of them are concentrated in the Cabo Delgado region in the north. So this is an attempt to draw a wedge between that region of the country with all of its natural resources and potential wealth to divide them from the rest of the country of Mozambique. So yes, it is definitely a threat to the national security of the country. It's also a threat to the overall development objectives of the Southern African Development Community, which Mozambique is a founding member.
Thanks for that, Mr. Bayomi Azikiwe from the Pan-African Newswire, and stay tuned for more.
There are constant reports of beheadings in Cabo Delgado villages. In an attack on a different village in April, 50 people were beheaded or shot dead. Women are also abducted in such raids, sparked by gunshots and setting homes ablaze.
Urgent measures are required today to protect civilians in northern Mozambique, where many people are dying and thousands are forced to flee their homes.
The international community to act, and acting is acting now.
we should not wait, because we have 424,000 IDPs, internally displaced people. This is the UN side, but from the government side, they are talking about 570,000.
The assailants have violently seized swaths of territory and stepped up their offensive in recent months. Many of the refugees are trapped in conflict areas, and many resort to hiding in the bush for days. So how did our gas-rich region come to this?
I don't think it's been successful at all. This is an attempt. What is taking place in Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique, to get a foothold or a beachhead, particularly in areas that have strategic natural resources, energy resources, such as Mozambique. And all along the coast of East Africa and Southern Africa, there have been huge findings of natural gas, of oil, and of course, this has created a scramble on the part of international finance capital to dominate this region even further.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Abayomi Miyazikiri.
Since the insurgency began in October 2017, more than 2,000 people have reportedly been killed, more than half of whom are civilians. Thousands of people have been displaced, having to seek refuge in nearby towns and cities. With many districts in the north having been cut off, some areas have been denied any humanitarian aid for over 6 months.
The crisis in Cabo Delgado rapidly escalated in 2020, with attacks and fighting forcing tens of thousands of people from their homes every month. Nearly 530,000 people are now internally displaced in Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and Niassa, almost five times the number registered 9 months ago in March. People fleeing violence in Cabo Delgado have been exposed to severe violations and abuses, and we are especially concerned for the plight of children and women.
That has made the protection of civilians inside and outside the conflict-affected areas a grave task. The Mozambique's government has even called for international help to tackle the insurgency. What options does Mozambique have in seeking help from neighbors or other world countries?
Well, the Southern African Development Community, which has 15 member states, has already offered to provide military forces if the government of Mozambique felt it self-threatened or felt it necessary. They're willing to deploy forces to Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique. Zimbabwe is also on its own, even though it's also a leading member of SADC, has offered to send troops. Mozambique had Zimbabwean troops during the 1980s when they were under threat.
Massacre in northern Mozambique has led to international concern about security in the region. Civilians, and especially women and children, are the ones enduring dreadful human rights violations, particularly as COVID-19 rages on in Cabo Delgado province.
The UN High Commissioner has urged all armed actors to take urgent measures to protect civilians, but Mozambique is left on its own to take on the militants. In the meanwhile, the communities will have to deal with killings, maiming, looting, destruction of houses and public and religious facilities, abductions and abuses of girls and women. How does the nation deal with such atrocities, and what role do foreign powers play?
I don't think it's been successful at all. This is an attempt. What is taking place in Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique to get a foothold or a beachhead, particularly in areas that have strategic natural resources, energy resources, such as Mozambique. And all along the coast of East Africa and Southern Africa, there have been huge findings of natural gas, of oil, and of course, this has created a scramble on the part of international finance capital to dominate this region even further.
The militants are based in the densely forested oil and gas-rich northeast corner of Mozambique. The DAESH supporters use operational techniques similar to those from conflicts in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Mozambique is an important part of the DAESH project to strengthen the Takfiri's presence in southern Africa.
As fighting in the northern province of Cabo Delgado intensifies, Mozambique's president is asking other leaders in southern Africa for help.
The problem of Mozambique, the problem of Zimbabwe, problem of Zambia, of Namibia, of Botswana, everywhere. And this is why. But the target reachable, we believe that we together are going to work out to make sure that our region is peaceful.
The expansion of the insurgency, which began along the coastal area of Cabo Delgado, has now reached into the heartland of the Makonde tribe. According to Mozambique's officials, the militants are being equipped and trained by foreign affiliates of the ISIS or Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Daesh formally adopted the Mozambique wing of its Central African province, known as ISCAP. Mr. Azikiwe, how do you evaluate the spread of ISIS takfiris in the region?
There's an attempt for these groups to get a foothold on the continent. They have not been able to effectively penetrate the Southern Africa region due to a lot of it has to do with the coherency of the political and economic programs in the region. But they are going to continue to try in order to disrupt the developmental process in Southern Africa and Africa as a whole.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Azikiwe.
International oil firms such as French company Total have so far been unaffected by the conflict, but the expansion of the insurgency has also frightened the West. It is claimed that it is ready to help the government tackle insurgency with cooperation from South Africa and Tanzania.
Many people have been forced to move multiple times, and the situation of those affected by the conflict is worsening rapidly. More than 2,000 people have been killed since the conflict started in 2017. In the violence, houses have been looted and burned, families separated, and health centers and schools seriously damaged. Access to agricultural land has been blocked, and other economic activities curtailed. There's a serious indication that this crisis could spread beyond the country's borders if it goes unstopped.
The Mozambican military, which relies on private military contractors from Zimbabwe and South Africa, has reportedly shown a weak performance in its confrontation with the militants or terrorists. The Mozambique insurgency is one of the many others underway in Nigeria, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. The militants are reportedly well organized and have good logistics. I'm Obara Kenya. Please share your views with us. Until next time, when you come back for another episode of Africa Today, goodbye and take care.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Light. A hotel in a ski resort in Kashmir has come up with a creative idea to keep its visitors warm and amused in the winter. The Kalahoy Green Heights has an igloo cafe where tourists can enjoy hot drinks and food in sub-zero temperatures. All the tables in the Eskimo-style cafe are made of ice and snow. As many as 16 people can sit and chill out in the igloo at any given time. The Icy Cafe is 25 feet round. It has elements of local architecture like an arched door and patterns on the curved walls.
A Russian firm has developed a flying taxi in an attempt to solve the problem of transportation in megacities. According to HoverServe company, testing the aircraft is now in the final stages. If successful, the drone taxi will go into mass production at the end of 2021. Special runways are not required as the vehicle is as big as a normal car and can land on a parking lot. Designers say it's capable of carrying two people or up to 300 kilograms of cargo.
The prototype of this flying machine will soon turn into a social device that we're going to build in 2021, and thus all the technologies that we've already built will be applied to this machine. The car will fly with a new type of engine that is installed here.
The flying taxi can reach an altitude of 150 meters and develop a speed of up to 200 kilometers per hour. The company says a flight with air taxi will cost around 27 cents per kilometer. The name Afghanistan may remind many people across the world of some bad news of war, violence and poverty. This is mainly due to the war in Afghanistan, which has been going on for over the past decades. Yet, there are some interesting stories about Afghanistan, its people, and their traditions and customs, such as Afghans' food culture. Amin Alami has more in this report.
When it comes to cooking and traditional dishes, Afghans have a lot to say. First of all, this is important to know that meat and rice are inseparable parts of Afghans' food culture.
Afghan traditional dishes like qabili, kebab, karai, mantu, ashak, bulani, and dugh are the some you can find available in restaurants, mainly serving traditional delicacies. Each one of these represents the food culture of specific tribes and ethnic groups.
Let's see what the manager of this restaurant has to say about some popular local dishes in Afghanistan.
When you want to talk about traditional foods of Afghanistan, you need to test different dishes that are, of course, very delicious. For instance, qabili is a mixture of rice, carrot, cuisine, and lamb meat. Northern Afghanistan is the home to this delicious food, while Western Herat province is well known for its delicious khichdi.
There are some key factors which should be taken into consideration when talking about Afghan food culture. As Afghans themselves say, their food is highly organic. They believe the food culture has made Afghans' bodies much stronger than those who do not have organic meals and their food culture.
We can't leave out meat from cooking. Additionally, our food culture is based on using organic products. This has even helped us have a stronger body.
As there is a wide variety of delicious dishes here, the good news is that the prices are not high. For example, you can serve a complete lunch menu at one of the top restaurants in Kabul by spending at most $15.
If you compare food prices in Afghanistan and other countries, you will find out that you can have the best dish in a top restaurant in Afghanistan by paying less than $20. The quality of food in our country is also better.
As observers say, Afghanistan has many capabilities and interesting attractions to be truly introduced for the globe if the war and politics allow this wounded land to breathe. Syed Amin Alimi, Kabul.
After nearly 3 years of conservation efforts, a group of newborn leaf monkeys have been recently spotted in southwest China. The rare monkeys, which fall under China's first-class national protection program, were spotted earlier this month in Mangshi City in Yunnan province. The baby monkeys sport golden fur, which will gradually turn grey when they are about 3 months old. Forest keepers have been noting an increase in the number of monkeys and expect their population to continue growing as biodiversity is improving.
Since the beginning of this year, we have spotted 11 little golden monkeys and several pregnant adult monkeys. It can be estimated that the number of these golden newborns will increase to around 20 by April.
Leaf monkeys are spread across western Yunnan as well as in eastern and northern Myanmar. Over the past few years, Yunnan's local government has strengthened protection for the animals. It's estimated there are now approximately 400 leaf monkeys in Mangshi.
A French-Swiss artist spray paints a huge fresco on the grounds of Cape Town as part of a global project aimed at fostering unity in a polarized world. The 31-year-old artist tries to convey his message of togetherness in his movement called Beyond Walls. The project consists of frescoes depicting two hands clasping each other's forearms around the world. South Africa's Cape Town represents an essential step of the project to its history marked by apartheid. The self-taught artist says he wants to create the biggest human chain in the world, and Cape Town is his next step.
Because for me, I really trust that it's sewn together
that humanity can respond to the biggest challenge of our time. And this is this message that I want to do by making huge fresco with biodegradable paint directly on the grass. It is a worldwide project, and the idea is to create the biggest human chain to speak about togetherness. And today in town, this is the ninth step of this project.
Saipe uses paint made out of charcoal, chalk, water and milk proteins to create his art, making it eco-friendly. He was also named one of the most influential young artists by Forbes magazine for his art, which is best viewed from aerial footage. His temporary biodegradable images have been previously painted on lawns in 8 cities, including Paris, Andorre, Geneva, Berlin, Ouagadougou, and Istanbul.
Scientists have discovered a 20 million year old fossilized tree with intact branches and roots on the Greek island of Lesbos. The 19 meter long tree was found near a petrified forest formed millions of years ago by a volcanic eruption. A thick layer of ash had preserved the tree. Since excavations began 25 years ago, this is the first time a tree in such proper condition has been uncovered in the area. Experts have been studying the unique forest to gather information of plants and animals and to reconstruct the ecosystem that existed 20 million years ago.
In Slovenia, two climbers have dared to scale Europe's tallest chimney. Janja Grunbrej and Domen Skofic managed to complete the challenge in 7 hours and 32 minutes. They describe the experience as the most difficult one in their professional lives. The 360-meter-high tower at the Trebaville Power Station is located in eastern Slovenia. It is known as the world's longest artificial multi-pitch climbing route.
Oh, isn't this sweet? A baby panda gluing to a zookeeper's leg has grabbed attention on social media, with her video receiving at least 4 million hits on YouTube alone. 6-month-old Fu Bao lives in a South Korean zoo. Her video went viral, showing the cub gripping her keeper's leg during a regular checkup. The cute panda refused to let the keeper go, even when he tried to walk away. Fu Bao is the first giant panda born in South Korea. Her parents arrived in the country in 2016 as part of China's panda diplomacy. Fu Bao has received enormous attention since her birth, with her video posted on the zoo's social media. Elephants at a zoo in the U.S. state of Arizona have enjoyed a rare snowy day, romping joyfully under the white flurry. While most of animals in Ride Park Zoo cozied up in the warmth, the elephants could not resist the snowfall in the sun-kissed state. They stayed out, with baby elephants splashing in their enclosure's pond and rolling in the mud. The baby elephants saw the snowfall for the first time in their life. Frosty flakes made their way to Arizona on Tuesday. That was a surprise for many in the U.S. West, which is plagued by drought.
That's it for the life thing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.